Support for this podcast of Which Way LA comes from City National Bank, where business and individuals experience tailored financial solutions to help meet their financial goals. CNB.com.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Merging airlines, reforming politics, and managing public land. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. The merger of United and Continental will leave the U.S. with just four major airlines. Will the combined carriers finally start making money? Will that mean fewer flights and higher fares? Also on Which Way LA, would taking the parties out of primary elections take the jackass quotient out of state politics? We'll hear about Proposition 14 on next month's ballot. And how come Olvera Street merchants are getting a rent increase while a billionaire may get public property for a dollar a year? First, here's the news. Werman Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Proposition 14 would take the parties out of primary elections and let voters pick any candidate they choose. Would they go for moderates instead of extremists? We'll hear a debate tonight. We'll also hear about the latest rent dispute on LA's Olvera Street and the possibility of giving billionaire Eli Broad 82,000 square feet of public land for a dollar a year. Those stories in just a few minutes. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. 2 years ago, Continental Airlines backed away from merging with United. Last month, United began a flirtation with U.S. Airways. Suddenly, Continental had a change of heart and over the weekend completed what some airline experts are calling a shotgun wedding. United and Continental now plan to become the world's largest airline. Jed Mowad covers the industry for The New York Times. Good to have you on our program.
Oh, good to be here.
Tell us a bit about the surprising merger of United and Continental, although there was, of course, an earlier romance.
There was an earlier romance. I mean, it was a courtship. This was kind of the wedding everyone was wanted to see. 2 years ago, like you said, Continental and United were very, very close. Indeed, I think they were just a few hours away from announcing that they were merging. But essentially, the bride, Continental, left the groom at the altar. Continental got cold feet. If you go back to 2008, oil prices were rising, and United's financial health was very much was very weak, and was giving pause to Continental. Fast forward 2 years later, the environment has changed. Oil prices, while high, have gone down a little bit. United's balance sheet and financial health is much better. And the industry executives have been calling for mergers and consolidation. And so United started talking with U.S. Airways a few months ago. And, by Continental's account, caught them by surprise. And so it really only took about 3 weeks for this whole deal to get put together, which was remarkably fast. But a lot of the groundwork essentially had been done 2 years ago.
So this is going to be a $3 billion stock swap, United buying Continental, United ending up with 55% of the company. Who's actually going to run it?
So Jeff Smysak, who's the chairman and CEO of Continental, is going to be the new CEO of the company, and the Glenn Tilton, who's United's chairman, remains as chairman for 2 years and then steps down, and Jeff Smysak also becomes chairman. So they're as usual in these big mergers, they're calling it a merger of equal, and essentially United is a slightly larger company. They have 46,000 employees versus Continental's 40,000. The company stays in Chicago. It will be based in Chicago. It will be called United, and United shareholders will own 55%, like you said. So, in my mind, though it will be run by Continental's chief executive, in my mind, it's really United buying Continental.
Glenn Tilton, the man who's been running United, has been very controversial since he has been there. Came from the oil industry. I gather that flight attendants wear buttons or have been known to wear buttons saying Glenn must go. Is this regarded as a great victory for him?
Well, in a sense, it is. I mean, essentially, he kind of sort of outlived his critics, if you will. He came in 2002 after a 30-plus year career in the oil business. He ran Texaco, was for a little while the chairman of the Chevron Texaco. Chevron bought Texaco back then. And then he was brought in to, you know, while United was really on the verge of bankruptcy. Of course, a few months later, after he became chairman, the company went into bankruptcy. But he really had some very contentious relations with his employees, and the unions did not like him. And he pushed for a very dramatic and very substantial concessions using bankruptcy proceedings, and essentially kept the company in bankruptcy for 3 years, which was the longest bankruptcy in the industry, to essentially cut costs. And this is the airline industry it does not like to see outsiders, but perhaps an outsider was needed to turn United around. And he had two goals at the time. One was to return United to profitability, and the second one was to merge it. And United is not yet profitable, though it will turn a profit this year. And the merger still needs to be approved, but it's certainly on tracks.
Jad Mowat, again, covers the airline industry for The New York Times. Let's take a look at Continental. Lauren Steffi is business columnist at the Houston Chronicle. Continental is headquartered in Houston. Lauren Steffi, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Tell us a bit about Jeff Smyzik. He's been a lawyer for Continental, but the CEO for a relatively short time. And since he's been CEO, Continental has been somewhat less passenger-friendly than it was before.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, he's actually been at the airline for about 15 years. He came up through the legal department, and he was brought in during the mid-90s when they were coming out of bankruptcy and the airline was going through a very fundamental restructuring. They were trying to put the rather difficult past they'd had under Frank Lorenzo with terrible labor relations. They wanted to put that behind them, and they adopted this idea of happy employees, happy customers. That was what they wanted to foster, and so you saw Continental kept in-flight amenities such as, you know, free meals and coach and more legroom and things like that much longer than the other airlines did. Their hope was that if you kept your customers happy, eventually, you know, profitability would follow. That hasn't happened, and I think, you know, with Jeff Smyzik coming in, he's more willing to take chances than his predecessor was, and, you know, he's realized that you know, they've tried all that stuff, it hasn't worked, it's time to do something different, and, you know, while he didn't agree with a merger 2 years ago, I think the combination of Delta and Northwest has changed the competitive dynamic in the industry to the point that he now thinks he can make this work.
You know a lot of people around Houston and a lot of people in Continental. Is there concern about the cultures, given that Continental still certainly has a residue of the happy employee, happy customer philosophy, whereas United is pretty much known for something else?
That is going to be the biggest issue in this merger is getting that culture or addressing that culture issue. People here at Continental are very, very worried about it. They see this almost as a stab in the back that, you know, after the sacrifices they've made during bankruptcies and previous, you know, concessions in labor talks, that now, you know, he comes in a few months after he gets here, he basically sells the airline and moves it to Chicago. That's going to be a big problem for him. It's something he's really going to have to work at overcoming because even though he's been at the company a long time, he hasn't been CEO long enough to where he's really won over the employee loyalty. You know, they're still trying to figure out what kind of a CEO he is, and here he is, you know, basically selling the company. It's going to be difficult, and as difficult as it is here, it'll probably be even more difficult when he gets to Chicago and confronts the United workforce.
Lauren Steffi with the Houston Chronicle. Back to Jad Mowat with the New York Times. Why so fast? Why did this suddenly gel the way it did? Is it something about the economy?
It's partly about the economy, obviously, economy picking up, business travelers returning. It's partly, like Lauren mentioned, the Delta-Northwest merger, which kind of sets a template. And it's partly competition from domestically from the low-cost carriers who keep gaining market share. And globally, this is an industry that's becoming much more globalized. globally, these airlines need size to essentially offer their customers end-to-end service.
Severin Borenstein is professor of business economics and public policy at the Haas School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley. And, Professor, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on.
You've been involved in airline mergers as an advisor before. What do you think about this? And is it really true that, as we heard earlier and as given as a rationale for this, that what the airlines need to do is get bigger?
No, I actually don't think the airlines need to get bigger. I think this merger in the end is going to end up hurting consumers. It's pretty clear that this merger is not about improving efficiency to benefit consumers. It's about reducing the size of the industry. In fact, just in the last week, both the CEO of US Air and the CEO of American Airlines have said, consolidation is good for us even if we're not part of it. And that's what they like to see. They like to see fewer planes in the air, less competition, so that they can raise their prices. Now, the industry responds that they've been losing money for the last decade, and they've lost a lot of money since deregulation. That's true, but the U.S. antitrust laws are quite clear that losing money isn't an excuse for anti-competitive mergers. And I think it's quite possible that this one is going to be one that will give the airlines more power to raise prices and will make them more profitable, but in the end that will hurt consumers. Nobody thinks that the industry is in long-term financial distress, that it's just going to disappear. It definitely has gone through some rough times when the economy goes down, but you got to remember they also made a lot of money in the prior to 2008 for the prior 5 years and prior to the economy turning down in 2000. So they have good periods too.
What are their alternatives at this point if they're not making money?
Oh, what's going to happen if this merger doesn't happen, and even if it does, airlines are going to continue to ground planes as they've been doing. Remember, even though demand is way down, flights are more full than ever. So airlines are very good at grounding planes when demand turns down. They do lose money on those planes when they're on the ground, but that's the nature of the business. You're guessing at what demand is going to be. Gradually what will happen is demand will turn up again, and those planes will start flying again, and they'll even start buying new planes again. The extremely high load factors we see, over 80% of the seats are full, will continue. And within a few years, the airlines will be making a lot of money again. Now, the airlines that are arguing, well, we really need to be allowed to do this because we're losing so much money, certainly don't want the government turning around 5 years from now when they're making a lot of money and saying, well, now you're making too much money, so we're going to go after you. And they shouldn't. We should have a consistent antitrust policy, and that policy should be mergers are a good thing when they're done for efficiency reasons. I'm skeptical that this one's being done for efficiency reasons. I think it's being done to consolidate the industry and raise prices.
Severin Borenstein, again, professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Vaughn Cordell is a former pilot at United Airlines. He's now chief analyst and managing partner at Airline Forecasts in Washington. Vaughn Cordell, welcome to you.
Thank you.
What do you say?
Well, we've been building these models on the airlines for about 20 years, and we released a white paper yesterday. And what we found in our study is that the airlines have cumulatively lost money since deregulation in the last decade, $70 billion, which represents 5.7% of sales. The efficiencies of a merger are quite substantial. We estimate that mergers of a typical network airline is around $2 billion. Now, that cost and revenue synergy would not exist without the merger. Now, the revenue synergy does not come from raising fares. It comes from the scope economies that are enhanced when two airlines join forces. Now, United Airlines and Continental represented 17.7% of the domestic-only capacity in 2009. Well, if you go back 15 years, United Airlines was about that size, the same size as the combined entity. So these airlines have shrunk 21 to 30% over the last decade. The point we make in the white paper is that the network airlines have to be profitable enough to serve those thinly populated short-haul flights into small communities. That's one issue. The low-cost model is not designed to do that, and they have zero incentive to do so. Low-cost model is more point-to-point. And
the low-cost model would be Southwest, JetBlue.
Southwest, AirTran, JetBlue, Spirit, Frontier. Now, they have a point-to-point model that is about 20% more productive than the network airline. So the efficiency comes in removing a lot of overlapping functions from these network airlines that have been in basically a downward death spiral for over a decade. So the economy and the traveling public need healthy networks. They are not healthy. They've been in a slow liquidation for a decade, and they are currently on a path to failure. We make a very powerful case that Continental and United were not viable standalone airlines. Same case for U.S. Air and American. American likely ends up in bankruptcy. U.S. Air has already filed bankruptcy twice. Continental has filed bankruptcy twice. United filed bankruptcy in 2003. Delta and Northwest filed bankruptcy. So it's not in the interest of the traveling public or the economy at large to have a weak, feeble network system. So there's different models, hybrid models, regionals, low-cost, major networks, and they have to hook up to the global network.
So is this going to be good then for consumers?
It's good for consumers because the alternative is even worse. So mergers have been viewed as failures in the past, but that's not the proper perspective. If American buys TWA, they're getting rid of a weak competitor. It can be viewed as a horrible financial failure. But in fact, the alternative was even worse.
Okay.
So it has to be viewed in relative terms.
Von Cordell, again, at Airline Forecast, former airline pilot, now an analyst of the industry. Severin Borenstein at UC Berkeley, back to you. What do you say to this, particularly the question of serving smaller communities, which the big networks can do, but the low-cost airlines can't, according to Von Cordell?
The big networks serve those small communities when serving them is profitable. They don't do it on a charitable basis. And whether they are merged into a gigantic carrier doesn't have a big effect on the profitability of that service. But in any case, if it does, then it should give them a competitive advantage to grow on their own. They don't need to do this through merger. If those were the real goals of this merger, you wouldn't see the CEO of U.S. Airways or the CFO of American Airlines saying, this is good for us to have United merge with Continental. If they were facing a competitor who now was going to be stronger and more efficient and was going to be able to undercut them and compete more aggressively against them, they would view this as bad news. But in fact, they view this as good news because they see this as consolidation in the industry. The industry has definitely lost money over many years. And they will continue to lose money when there are economic downturns, and then they will make money when there are upturns. And they will, in quite possibly, overinvest at times and lose a lot of money. But there is no indication that the American airline industry is headed for complete disaster, as was just suggested. In fact, we have been hearing this for 30 years now. But if you look at the total amount of service in this industry, it has constantly expanded. At the same time, the industry has said, oh, we need to be able to raise our prices and to survive, they have continued to invest and expand. Now, I think they are learning a lesson, and they're not going to invest as much, and that's good. They shouldn't. They shouldn't overinvest during those boom times. But this merger, I think there's very little suggestion that this merger is actually going to make them more efficient and a more effective competitor. And if it were, I don't think the other airline CEOs would be happy to see it.
Von Cordell, are the airlines in general more concerned about their shareholders than they are about their passengers?
Well, they have to be concerned about the shareholders because the shareholders are a key stakeholder. To be viable, these airlines have to satisfy the consumer, labor, and the shareholders. It's the stakeholder model. The good professor is wrong on quite a few points, and it's a good thing he's not running these airlines, or those stakeholders would suffer quite significantly. The market concentration he's talking about, we've run extensive studies using the Herfindahl Index, and we measured that market concentration every quarter, every year for every airline, all the way back to 1977, the year before deregulation. So we have a very full understanding of what this means and what is the optimal strategy for the airline. Sure, US Air and American's CEO are quite happy to see a merger because that market concentration, as measured by the Herfindahl Index, goes up. But it goes up to a level that's still considered by economists as perfect competition. So pricing power does increase, but the problem is pricing power has been too low for too long. So there has to be a rationalization. The cost efficiencies are quite significant in these mergers, and it's that extra $3 to $6 billion that can be divvied up among those three stakeholders to satisfy them to the degree that makes the airline viable.
So, Severin Bernstein, what about the Herfindahl Index, and should we? Does everything turn on that?
Look, I worked at the Civil Aeronautics Board during airline deregulation. I've been studying the industry for 30 years, and I have talked to leaders in all of the major airlines. They understand that they would like to have more pricing power. They understand that this is far from a perfectly competitive industry. The Herfindahl Index is an aggregate measure of concentration that is, in this case, being applied to the entire United States. You don't fly in the entire United States. You fly from Newark to San Francisco. You fly from Detroit to Memphis. What you care about is the concentration on those routes. And on some of those routes, the concentration is quite high. So this idea of taking just a nationwide index in order to analyze competition is not only rejected by almost all economists at this point, it's also being rejected by the Department of Justice and has been for years as a major decision maker. It is considered a starting point, a guideline to first look at an industry. But the antitrust authorities have always said it is just a starting point. You have to go beyond that, and you have to look at concentration and competition as it actually plays out in the industry. And in the industry, the competition is not across the United States. It's route by route and hub by hub and airport by airport.
We're going to leave the Herfindahl Index to the battling economists on our program. The question of the Department of Justice is certainly one that we need to deal with. Lauren Steffi still with us, business columnist at the Houston Chronicle. What about the history of mergers in the past? Why is it said that of the 20 that have occurred since 1978, only two of them have gone smoothly?
Well, because there's so many things that can go wrong in these mergers. I mean, you're talking about merging some very complex systems here, both from computer systems to route networks, maintenance operations, and then you have the labor issues. Labor has been a major impediment to making these mergers work. What tends to happen is you get runaway costs, you get a lot of unhappy customers, and we were talking earlier about the shareholders. Most airline investors have long-term investors got out of this business a long time ago because there just isn't any returns there. So, this is an industry that has failed all three of those constituencies regularly. And 10 years ago, a top airline executive told me that, the industry is fundamentally flawed. And that's what airlines have been trying to overcome ever since deregulation. One of the problems that we have that the Department of Justice has to take into account is if you don't allow these guys to merge and you have all this additional capacity out there, and they decide to start grounding planes as opposed to, combining routes as a way of taking out the extra capacity, then who steps in? Because what we've seen is that every time capacity comes out, an airline files for bankruptcy, an airline cuts routes or whatever, somebody else steps in. You have a startup carrier or you have an expansion by an existing carrier. The planes never actually go away.
What about Southwest and JetBlue? I don't know about JetBlue making money, but I believe Southwest does. Certainly, it's increasing its share of the market. Lauren Steffi, how's it able to do that?
Southwest is a completely different animal. They don't operate a hub-and-spoke system. They fly a lot of the point-to-point routes we were talking about earlier, which are much more profitable. They don't, although they serve a lot of small markets, they choose those markets carefully. They run a more efficient operation in terms of getting their planes in the air. They turn them around faster at the gates. They have a much more productive labor contract with all of their work groups. They're the most heavily unionized airline, but the productivity gains that they get from those contracts enables them to get more work out of their employees. And up until recently, they were continuing to grow at a very rapid rate, and that growth allowed them to keep their costs down across their entire network.
Up until recently, what's happened lately?
They've kind of run out of places to grow, actually. They've had to go into, you've seen them go into places like LaGuardia and New York and some of the, you know, the Boston area, some of the concentrated East Coast markets that they had avoided for many years because they didn't feel that they could keep the quick turns on their planes and whatnot going. But now they're going in there because they can't afford to ignore the huge base of passengers that's available to them. But it is changing their model, and they're going to have a struggle of their own in terms of maintaining that historic profitability going forward.
Severin Borenstein, what can the other airlines learn from Southwest? Is that a model that could be replicated at least up until it gets so successful it can't grow anymore?
Well, I think there's some things the other airlines can learn, particularly about the efficiency of running ground operations, which the other airlines have tried to pick up, and the flexibility of using labor, which has been Southwest's real key to their success. But it is a different model. They do run a more point-to-point system, although it is not the case that they fly purely point-to-point. Almost a quarter of Southwest customers now change planes. But it isn't a model that is going to be scalable up to a national network carrier that wants to include large international operations. On the labor side, I think Southwest has been tremendously successful, and other airlines are trying to emulate what they do.
Lawrence Duffy, is there room for the American carriers to do more international flying? Is that one of the things that United Continental would be looking to do?
Well, clearly, the combination of United and Continental is aimed at leveraging the international networks. You get United's Pacific network, Continental's South American network, and that's one of the benefits that they're talking about. But part of the reason they have to do that is there is growing competition in the international markets as well. You're seeing some consolidation there, guys like BA buying Iberia and things like that. The international market is getting much more competitive, and the strategy of focusing on international routes, which is something Continental had been doing for the last few years, it's not as lucrative as it once was. So the idea is you get a bigger global network, you get a bigger footprint, if you will, and again, you're trying to drive revenue into the system.
Well, thank you all very much for being on our program. We will see if, in fact, this merger does go through. The Justice Department is going to have something to say about that, and it will take months for them to make a determination. In the meantime, we'll see what happens with the other airlines as well. What about American? What about U.S. Airways? Lawrence Duffy, business columnist at the Houston Chronicle, Severin Borenstein at UC Berkeley, professor of business economics, Vaughn Cordell, former United pilot, now managing partner at Airline Forecast in Washington, and our earlier guest, Jad Moad, who covers the airline industry for the New York Times. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. In a moment, getting political parties out of the primaries and different prices for public lands on Which Way LA. Warman Olney back with Which Way LA. Supporters of Proposition 14 in next month's election say it would decrease the jackass quotient in the legislature and Congress. The measure itself would open primary elections so that instead of choosing only a Democrat, a Republican, a Green, or a Libertarian, voters could pick anybody they wanted. Only the top two would run in the November election, regardless of party. Jason Olson is director of Independent Voices. He favors Proposition 14. Jason Olson, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's actually independentvoice.org if folks want to look us up while we're talking.
Okay. What's the jackass quotient? What does that mean?
I love the term the jackass quotient, by the way. I'm going to have to start using that myself more often. Well, right now, I don't think anybody who picks up a newspaper, watches the news, is surprised to know that the state and much of the country is in real disarray. We have politicians who get elected in a very partisan system, controlled by the parties and the special interests, that are there essentially to serve those parties and special interests, and are not there to serve the people of the state and the country. And what Prop 14 would do is it would get rid of our partisan election process for governor, for statewide election like legislature and Congress, and give us a system very similar to our municipal elections, like we do for mayor, city council. Everybody would run on the same ballot. All the voters would be able to just pick the best candidates, and the top two vote-getters would then go on to a runoff-style election in the fall. Specifically, it would empower California's 3.4 million declined estate voters, that means that's California's version of independent without a party, to be able to fully participate in the process in which they're currently, we're locked out. The parties control how we're able to vote.
How do they control the way you're able to vote?
Well, before every, you know, the current primaries are what's called partisan primaries. That means all the candidates that run for governor, state legislature, or Congress, they run in a party election. You know, the Democrats all vote for the Democrats that they want to select, Republicans all vote for the Republicans, et cetera, et cetera. In 1996, the voters of the state wanted to change that system. We passed a system where any voter could walk into the polling place and request a party ballot and just vote for the candidates that they wanted to vote for. Voter turnout went up by something like 1 million voters per election cycle, but the Democrats Republicans sued to have that thrown out. We then returned to a system where only Democrats could vote for Democrats, only Republicans could vote for Republicans, and if the parties wanted to, they could allow declined estate voters, independents, to be able to participate. Well, there's a real up and down history with that. Initially, they didn't allow us to participate. Last presidential election, the Republicans shut us out of their presidential primary. And of course, as everybody knows, those are the primaries are the real elections where all the real decisions get made.
Okay, Jason Olson, again, director of Independent Voice, supporting Proposition 14. Eric Bauman is vice chair of the California Democratic Party. He's head of the L.A. Democratic Committee. And Eric Bauman, before you begin, I'm assuming that Republicans are with you in opposing Proposition 14.
You know, without a doubt. And I want to point out that 80% of the voters in the state of California are allied with the party. So when we talk about disenfranchising voters, it seems to me that 80% of the voters have chosen to belong to a party, whether that's the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the Green Party, the American Independent Party, et cetera. So let's be clear that the majority of voters prefer to align with a political party. The Proposition 14 is not what it's advertised to be. The supporters of it like to call it an open primary, which it really isn't. It's a top two primary. And what it means for sure is that anybody who's a Libertarian or a Green Party person in this state will never, ever, ever make it to a November election. It's not possible because once the primary election is passed, they're no longer going to be eligible because, let's face it, the top two voters in the state in most districts, in virtually every district, are going to be Republicans or Democrats. But what people need to understand is that this was part of a backroom deal that was cooked up by Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Sacramento politicians in order to get Abel Maldonado's vote for a budget. This isn't a good government ploy. This was a backroom deal cut by Arnold Schwarzenegger to achieve his ends. And what this does is it disenfranchises voters. What this does is it says that if you're a Green Party member or Libertarian, American Independent, Reform Party, Natural Law Party, you will never have a chance to vote for your candidate again. The other thing that it does that's extraordinarily...
Wait a minute. Why does it say you'll never have a chance? You can vote for anybody you want to. If they're on the ballot, you can vote for them.
They're not going to be on the ballot in November ever. It's never going to happen.
In November. Well, have they ever been on the ballot in November prior?
Of course. They're in the ballot in November every election. Green Party is always on the ballot. Libertarian Party is always on the ballot. Because what happens under the primary system is the top vote getter in each party advances to the general election. But under this, that's not true any longer. It's only the top two vote getters. And here's something else that people need to know. In more than 16 districts around the state of California, the November election will be a Democrat against a Democrat. And in two districts across the state, it'll be a Republican against a Republican. So what's going to happen is Democrats are going to spend millions and millions of dollars in Democrat against Democrat warfare in the general election. That is what is part of the evil plot that underlies this particular measure that Arnold Schwarzenegger put on here. That's why this was a backroom deal and wasn't cooked up in the public. This wasn't signatures collected by average voters who cared about it. This was Arnold cutting a deal in Sacramento.
Eric Bauman, again, vice chair of the Democratic Party and in the state and head of the L.A. Democratic Committee. Jason Olson, back to you with Independent Voice. What about that? In November, independents couldn't vote for independents, and nor could any of the other party people vote for the people they wanted.
First of all, I think folks, you know, and the listeners in your audience, maybe we just need to take a little bit of a reality check here because, you know, when have the Democrats or the Republicans ever given two whits about the Green Party, the Libertarians, et cetera, et cetera? Never. In fact, you know, I'll guarantee you, as soon as if this thing failed or passed, they're going to abandon that argument one way or the other. They're interested in their own partisan control, and they think this is an argument that, in particular, could sway independent voters who, I think, harbor some good feelings towards the third parties. So let's actually take a look at.
So why take them off the ballot in November then? Why not allow them to be there?
Well, first of all, they're not necessarily going to be taken off the ballot. That's complete falsehood. So the way this would work is just like you vote for mayor or city council. What this does is it removes the partisanship from the election process. So rather than the elections being by party, all the candidates run on the same ballot. For instance, here in San Francisco, where I'm based. In 2003, we had a mayoral election that was very similar, mostly Democrats on the ballots, because that's San Francisco. But a Green Party candidate, Matt Gonzalez, won out into what was essentially the second round. We had a runoff election. So we had a Democrat and a Green Party candidate run for election here in the runoff for the mayorship of San Francisco. Not a very small city, if you will. So the argument that it would somehow disenfranchise third parties, I think it's a red herring. And it's being bantered about primarily by the major parties who, of course, as we all know, care so much about the third parties. It's not a real argument.
Eric Bauman, back to you. With the Democratic Party opposed to Prop 14, what's the virtue of party?
Well, first of all, let me just say, because one example could be cited out of the thousands of elections that have been held in California in the last 10 years doesn't hold water. And the fact that 80% of the people in California choose to identify with a party tells us that most voters prefer to belong and be involved in partisan politics.
Okay, why?
And let us be clear, because the Democratic brand stands for a progressive form of politics in which we put people first, in which we believe in every person having the right to health care and a good education system and social services. And for Republicans, it's for people who believe in a conservative approach, who believe in smaller government, who believe in less taxes and less government. But the bottom line is people identify with those two particular models, and that's the reason why almost 45% of the voters in California are Democrats, and 31% of them are Republicans. So all of this stuff about, oh, how, you know, it's terrible, it's partisan, you know, that's how people have chosen to register to vote. That's how people vote. And by the way, California is a big blue Democratic state.
Back to Jason Olson. Why is it that the people in favor, including yourself, of Prop 14 believe that somehow the candidates who are selected in November are going to be more moderate, less jackasses than those that are being elected now?
Well, let's move away from the I want to focus less on the who gets elected, because that's what the parties like to talk about.
Well, wait a minute. No. In the arguments on the ballot and elsewhere for this proposition,
well,
we keep hearing that we're
going to
get moderate people that aren't going to be extremists, and we're going to stop arguing over the budget all the time.
Well, the reason for that is not the candidates necessarily that get elected, but the people who are able to participate in the elections process. So when you have 3.4 million declined to state voters who are effectively shut out of the political process, now who are independents? Independents are people who care more about what's best for the state, about what's best for the country, than they care about what's best for the political parties and the special interests. Those are the exact kind of voters that we need to be empowering right now when the state and the country is in such crisis brought on by essentially 30-odd years of partisan warfare. Those are the exact kind of voters that we need to be having to participate in our political process and selecting our candidates. We need to free those folks up so that they can have a say in the process.
Eric Bauman, what about the argument that we would see moderate elected representatives instead of the people described as extremists who have gotten us into a gridlock and made it impossible to do anything in state government?
So first of all, let us be clear. Independent voters or declined to state voters absolutely have the right to vote in the general election in November in every single election, and to imply otherwise is an outright deception. Second of all, the Democratic Party has had its primaries open to independent voters since the Supreme Court changed the law in California. So again, that's a falsehood. This is a way to try to propel a certain image. Now, I'll tell you, there are some people in California who would like to see quote-unquote moderates run California. But, you know, this is a state that voted by nearly 70% for Barack Obama. This is a state where most people believe we should be cleaning up the environment and working on global warming and providing universal health care for people. That's a progressive viewpoint. And that doesn't mean that most people in California won't want moderates Okay, that's a falsehood that's created in the media that we want moderation. No, the reason that there's budget gridlock is because we have a requirement for a two-thirds majority in order to pass a budget in the Assembly and the Senate. Only two other states in the entire country have such a ridiculous rule.
Okay, don't blame the media. It's the people in favor of Prop 14 are saying that. Again, Jason Olson, the quality of the candidates who win is going to be better?
I think it's about the people that they're going to represent. I think when you have a partisan system that essentially, you know, Eric wants to say that, oh, well, independents are allowed to vote in the general election. Let's take a step back and look at how elections work in California. Most of the decisions in terms of who's going to win in November are made in the party primaries. That's because, first of all, most of the districts, not most of them, all of the districts in California and most of the districts in the United States of America have been gerrymandered so that either the Democrats or the Republicans essentially own them. That means that all the action, if you will, all the selection takes place in the party primary for the party that runs that election district. For instance, here in San Francisco, or probably a number of districts down in Los Angeles.
Okay. I think our listeners are familiar with that argument.
Yeah.
We're running short of time,
sure.
So let me ask Eric Bauman to respond to it as briefly as you can. Go ahead.
Well, look, here's the bottom line. At the end of the day, this is a deceptive measure that allows candidates to not even disclose what their partisan affiliation is.
What about the domination because of the way the district boundaries are drawn?
You know what? The voters of California passed Proposition 11. We are in the final election cycle before our districts will now be drawn by an independent commission. The voters just installed that system in the 2008 election. So that argument is now bogus. It no longer applies.
Okay. All right. That's all the time we have. Again, Eric Bauman with the Democratic Party and the Democratic Committee here in Los Angeles is against Prop 14. Jason Olson, Director of Independent Voice, he's in San Francisco, is for Prop 14. Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Warren.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Which Way LA. Olvera Street in downtown Los Angeles is part of a historical monument, El Pueblo de Los Angeles, supposedly designed to preserve the city's earliest lifestyle and culture. But 40 Olvera Street merchants are refusing to pay their full rent, and that could lead to evictions. Richard Guzman reports for the Downtown News. And Richard, good to have you on our program.
Hey, Warren, how are you?
Good. What's this dispute about? How did it begin?
Well, this is something that's been going on for years. The latest incarnation of it began about a year and a half ago when the city started, again, making attempts to raise rents to market rates for about 74 tenants on El Pueblo.
Raising to market rates. So now are they getting a break?
Well, a lot of experts have said that they've been paying well below market rates for, like I said, since last rate increase they had was in 87. So according to experts, they have been getting paying below market rates since then, at least since then.
So some are refusing to pay. What's that going to get them?
Possibly evicted. The city is currently preparing three-day notices to serve on 43 tenants that haven't paid their full amounts that were due April 1st. At the moment, they're talking with city attorney office and Councilman Jose Weaver's office to figure out how to proceed with those eviction notices.
What's their argument? Why do they say that they ought to be able to pay less than market rates?
Some of the tenants are saying that they agree with higher rents, but they don't agree with the rents that are being imposed. They want to negotiate long-term leases that are, I guess, closer to not as high as they're being proposed.
Is there some indication that what the city really wants is a different type of tenant?
I don't see that indication, no.
What about the complaint that the merchants in Olvera Street are really dealing with ticky-tacky, touristy kinds of materials and food that's not always very good?
Well, I really haven't heard those complaints much. I mean, I guess it's all a matter of taste, what you want to purchase and what you want to eat.
So are they then doing plenty of business?
They see over 2 million visitors a year. They're saying that they're not selling much, but none of them have opened up their books, so we're not really sure what kind of business they're doing.
So what would be lost if, in fact, there were evictions?
What do you mean by that?
Well, what would happen if there were evictions? Would somebody else come in and run the same kind of business? Would there be, would it be possible to keep Olvera Street in operation?
Presumably they would, I guess, rent out those empty spaces. That hasn't really been discussed yet.
So they haven't gotten to that point.
Not to that point yet, no.
That would be going a step too far, I guess. Mm-hmm. Is the real concern of the city the fact that it's running a deficit?
That seems to be one of the concerns. The city has subsidized El Pueblo for the last few years. It's gotten as high as almost $1 million, and raising the rents to market rates would cover that subsidy.
What are the merchants themselves saying about the value of what they do, the value to the city, and their importance to El Pueblo, the historical monument?
Well, they consider themselves a cultural landmark, kind of a living history lesson, if you will, which is one of the reasons why they say they deserve a break from the city.
And nobody else can do what they can do?
I don't know that.
No, I mean, is that what they're arguing?
Their argument is that they've been doing it since Oversea was started, and like I said, it's a historical landmark, and I mean, I don't know if anybody else could do it, but that is what they're saying, that they're the ones that have been doing it since the beginning.
Families are running these businesses?
Yes.
So there's a tradition in each of the families to keep them going.
Yes, that's one of their arguments.
Are they getting any response from the city council?
The city council, Councilman Weezer, has kind of vowed not to allow anybody to be evicted. He is for raising rents. He just doesn't want any of the tenants to lose their businesses.
So he's then involved. What's the total amount of money involved that we're talking about here?
For the month of April, they owe a total of $72,000.
$72,000, yeah. For the month, and so far not all of them have paid.
Yeah, 43 have paid out of 74.
Richard Guzman, city editor of the L.A. Downtown News. The Olvera Street controversy, once again, involves a total of $72,000. Another matter of municipal public policy involves $1 a year. That's what billionaire philanthropist and art collector Eli Broad might be paying for 82,000 square feet of city property across the street from Disney Hall. Tim Rutten is a columnist for the L.A. Times. And Tim, good to have you back on our program.
I'm very glad to be with you.
What is it that Mr. Broad wants to do with all that property?
Well, he has in mind a museum that would house the contemporary art holdings of both the Broad Foundation, which is one of the more distinguished institutional private collectors in the world, and the holdings from he and his wife's private collection.
What's the argument for letting him do it for $1 a year?
Well, because he would build the museum. He would pay to build the museum. He'd pay the architect's fees and that sort of thing, which I think would run about $30-40 million. And then his foundation would operate it. And there has been a great deal of competition to get this museum. At one point, Beverly Hills was vying to get him to come and build it there. Culver City for a while. Santa Monica has an offer on the table now, which offers him, I think, a similar square footage at $1 a year.
He's a billionaire. Mm-hmm. Why does he need the break on the property?
Well, because it's a civic amenity that would really help the Grand Avenue project, which is sort of at this moment on life support. It may not keep it alive, but it would be a tremendous addition to the Grand Avenue recreational and cultural corridor that begins up at Dodger Stadium and runs actually down as far as the Coliseum. And you'd have Disney Hall. It's right across the street from Disney Hall and the Coburn School and just sort of kitty-corner from the Museum of Contemporary Art, which Mr. Broad has also stepped in to save from its current financial distress. And so it creates a kind of nexus of places that would be very attractive to cultural tourists. And cultural tourists are a big new part of our economy, since tourism is one of our biggest earners here, and cultural tourists spend more than any other sort.
Why do we need a second contemporary art museum right across the street from the one we already have?
Because collectors have formidable egos. and you might well ask why Mr. Broad's collection isn't going to the County Art Museum, where he sits on the board as well, and to which he's been extremely generous over the years, and which had some expectation that it would eventually go there. I think that Mr. Broad felt that the museum never would display enough of the pieces from his collection, which he thinks are pretty swell, and he would like people to see them. Also, the Broad Museum, the Broad Foundation needs office space because one of the innovative things that they are doing is acting as a kind of lending library to university and public galleries across the country that are allowed to sort of borrow interesting or significant paintings from the museum for a time and then send them back. And so that would also be housed in this place.
I suppose it says something about the diversity of Los Angeles that we're talking about Olvera Street on the one hand and the Contemporary Art Museum on the other.
Yeah, you know, and they aren't that dissimilar. If I could go back, you know, to the Olvera Street discussion, you know, the subsidies to Olvera Street over the years, which is a, you know, Olvera Street for all its you know, its charm and sort of kitsch charm now, is a kind of fantasy of Los Angeles past, and the city has subsidized it for years and years and years. I mean, many of those merchants who are mom and pop merchants, or some of those families have been there for decades, operating those businesses, but many of them have 55-year leases. And there's, I don't know of any other place in America where you could get a 55-year lease on commercial property. And some of those places now are renting at about $1 a square foot. So it isn't as if these subsidies are foreign to our notions about how to encourage culture downtown.
Eli Broad's lease would be for 99 years.
His would be for 99 years, yeah. But he's also going to build the building. So, and maintain it, which the merchants at Olvera Street don't do. And in fact, I think if you looked at the revenues from Olvera Street, the city, the two-thirds of the revenue for the whole, that's a kind of separate authority that runs the plaza monument there. And I think two-thirds of the revenues actually come from the parking lots as opposed to the rents.
You mentioned the Grand Avenue project. Mr. Broad's also involved in that. In fact, he's chair of the board, isn't he? Is there
No. He is. No? Actually, he was. I said in a column that I wrote a couple weeks ago that he had been vice chairman of the board, but he has resigned from that position. And my colleague Christopher Hawthorne, in his piece last week, got that correctly. We just missed the fact that he'd stepped aside. He is not. He was, though. But look. I mean, if you were going to disqualify Eli Broad from participating in any sort of, you know, significant public effort that he'd either given to or advised in the city, I think you'd have a pretty hard time.
He has been indeed an extraordinary cultural and financial presence in this city, no doubt about that.
He's an assertive and generous visionary. He is also a person who likes to get value for his money and who has ideas about things, how to run, and isn't shy about expressing them. And we don't know for certain that this museum is going to come down here. He's still saying that he's interested in this Santa Monica site, and you know, I don't think you get to be Eli Broad by showing your cards too early in the game.
Okay, two very different cultural expressions, very close to each other in downtown Los Angeles. Tim Rutten of the Los Angeles Times, Richard Guzman with the Downtown News. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Which Way L.A., produced tonight by Gary Scott and Katie Cooper, managing producer Cameron Radziner, technical director Mike Newport. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for Which Way L.A. on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.